Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Good morning, Nashville. You're listening to Morning Drive live from the Wholesaling Studio, powered by RumbleOn.com. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson. So much breaking news happening today and just continues to come out regarding college football. And joining us now, we have Adam Rittenberg of ESPN. Adam, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Hey, good morning. Good to be on with you guys.
Thank you. So, news coming out. Dan Patrick's show tweeted this out about the Big Ten and Big 12 and about school voting and then the SEC wanting to go it alone with potentially adding teams from the other Power 5 conferences. I mean, lots of information there to unpack, obviously still all apparently and allegedly. But just wanting to get your thoughts first on what do you think about this potential thing happening? Is it something that we should expect for tomorrow, especially the Big Ten and Big 12? What are you feeling out there right now?
Right. Well, the Big Ten, you know, is very ready. I mean, we reported this yesterday that they have a large majority of their presidents that are prepared to postpone the season. They have not had a formal vote, at least that we've been able to confirm. And if they did have a formal vote, then they'd be announcing already that they were postponing. I think ideally they would like to get on board with another league, probably the Pac-12, in terms of making an announcement about postponing the fall season. The Pac-12 presidents are set to meet on Tuesday. You know, we're trying to see if that meeting is going to be moved up at all. But I think there's a sense because of the connection between the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and how the both leagues have approached this and just a lot of connections between their presidents and the similar types of schools that at the very least those leagues could announce together that they've decided to postpone the fall season, including football. So, you know, again, we don't know necessarily those numbers on the Pac-12 if they're as strong as they are in the Big Ten. But basically, there's only a few holdouts in the Big Ten at this point, unless their viewpoint from the presidential level has changed in the last few hours.
So, Adam, I want to reiterate appreciation for you coming on here because I know things are flying fast and you are grinding day and night on this. And I'm sure you saw Dan Patrick said something on his show this morning to the effect of there was a 12-2 vote. I'm assuming that was maybe a taking of temperature. You feel this way, you feel that way, not a formal vote. If that's true, can you envision anything happening between now and the formal vote that would change minds in that room?
Yeah, Joe, I'm thinking about that, and certainly the movement that, you know, the prominent players around college football launched last night, you have to at least be looked at. But that's what it is. It's not a formal vote because they would have announced already. We've not been told that a formal vote was taken, but you can go around the room and say, if we were to vote, where are you on this? And I think that's exactly where the Big Ten is at this point, with only a couple of schools that would like to go forward. And so, again, I don't know what would change the calculus unless, you know, there's maybe national presidential discussions from the other leagues, and there's new information that comes out that the Big Ten presidents would be more comfortable in holding off. One thing that's definitely circulating, and we'll have more about this on ESPN later today, is that there's studies that about the effects of COVID-19 on athletes, on anyone who has it. And there are some very alarming things around heart issues that are coming up. Everyone says that people recover from this at a high rate and young people don't get it and it's not a big deal for young people. You know, that's too simplistic of an argument. I think this information, which has absolutely been presented to the commissioners and it's now on the president's radar, has them very concerned. Now, you can say that it's a liability issue over health and safety. You can phrase it however you want. I mean, neither of us have run a university, and it's very easy if somebody gets really sick or passes away as an athlete from these long-term effects for that to turn into a huge, huge problem for a university. So, again, I'm hearing from coaches this morning that the leadership is spineless and why don't they just let us play? There's a lot more to this than even what the players are saying in their movement last night. So that's a long answer saying I don't think there will be much to change the minds, at least of the Big Ten presidents. And my sense is the Pac-12 presidents are in a similar position in terms of their thinking.
Again, Adam Rittenberg, senior writer for college football at ESPN, joining us on Morning Drive. And Adam, you put out a tweet about 30 minutes ago just about players organizing, not necessarily being called a union, but an advocacy group, and we're seeing a lot of players from across the country tweeting out, we want to play, and that the graphic as well that Trevor Lawrence especially put out about uniting the players and everything. What do you, are you hearing anything from the players as well in terms of just more about what they want in terms of organization? Because we can't call it a union per se, but how they want to be a part of this advocacy group going forward?
Right. Well, I think they want to have better. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here and we're talking about better communication, you know, so late in this game, and players wondering why they don't have a, you know, kind of a national safety protocol, and that there's concerns about just their comfort level in terms of playing during this pandemic, and really started with the Pac-12 group. I think just underscores that there is not enough central leadership in the sport, and it's not, you know, it's no secret to Joe, it's no secret to any of us who have covered college football for a long time that's one of the big problems, and I think it's playing out very publicly now. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I think these players should continue, even if the season is wiped out, to advocate for themselves and make sure that this type of thing can improve going forward and that their voices are heard. I think all players' voices need to be heard in this process, not, you know, just the Pac-12 group that organized, or not just the group that's now organizing who are saying we want to play, but we want these conditions met. You know, clearly there has to be better dialogue between the leadership in college athletics, commissioners, athletic directors, even presidents, and the athletes, because they're not being heard at a very, very important time. And so I think if there is one positive that comes out of this, even if the season is postponed or ultimately canceled for this 2020 cycle, it's that players are understanding and realizing the power that they have and coming forward and wanting to have that conversation. And I think those around the sport are recognizing that, even if it doesn't lead to anything immediately right now.
Yeah, a lot of things about this system that a lot of us have been talking about for a long time being illuminated right now, Adam. As we look forward here, can you envision a scenario in which the SEC resists and pushes forward and plays while the other leagues, or maybe just some of the other Power Five leagues, decide not to play?
Well, again, I think could I see it? I guess you can't rule anything out, Joe, but I would say that from a presidential level, it'd be very difficult. You know, as someone who's in charge of an entire university, to look at what could be done very soon in the Big Ten, could be done very soon in the Pac-12, and say we're just going to go forward and hope for the best, and hope that everybody stays as healthy as possible, and try to limit the outbreaks and give the people what they want. You know, could that be the position the SEC takes or the Big 12 takes? Sure, but I you know, the sources that we talked to over the weekend were pretty skeptical, even in those leagues, that those groups of presidents would be okay being essentially on an island here, because I think it's going to be more difficult. We already saw one group of five leagues, the Mid-American Conference, postpone their season. You know, in talking to coaches and others in those leagues, it's just very difficult to pull this off and meet all the safety standards, much less some of the long-term effects that we're now learning about from people who have had COVID-19. So I just think it's a really tough position to be in, but there's certainly political pressure, maybe more so on the SEC presidents and the Big 12 presidents to forge forward than there is in the Big Ten. It's just a different philosophy, and I think that's sort of playing out right now.
And looking forward to this, too, because we saw the one mid-major, but there's others that still haven't yet. And then we even look at maybe other divisions of football. I mean, for instance, I'm throwing out that the NAIA, still, they've canceled fall championships, but each conference has the ability to go on. Are there opportunities for other, the smaller conferences out there, just to make a bigger name for themselves, whether it is through TV deals or just bigger coverage?
There's always opportunity, but there's tremendous risk, too. If you want to take that risk at a school which has a fraction of the ability to pull this off. I mean, listen, you know, Joe knows this. He covered Michigan State. The Big Ten, it probably has the best collection of intelligence, of medical schools, of money. I mean, if anybody can pull it off, it's probably the Big Ten. And if they're saying, we don't feel comfortable doing this, and we can certainly debate the reasons, but if that league, which I've been told all along, watch the Big Ten, watch what happens in the Big Ten. If that league is saying no, and you're at an NAIA school and you think you can do this, then best of luck to you. Go collect that money, I guess, because that's a really, really tough look optically, I think, for anybody in a leadership position at those schools.
Yeah, I mean, there is a void, but as you said, it's also more difficult to do some of the things that should be in place to push forward. So, Adam, clearly there will be an attempt, if this all pushes forward as it appears right now, there will be an attempt to play in the spring. We don't know how a lot of things will look in society in terms of treatments, in terms of vaccine, all these things. But how do you think that that would look if, you know, let's say some things do break well in that way? Maybe there even could be a season with more fans in the stands than there would have been in the fall. How do you think it will look? How feasible right now do you think it is? Of course, not knowing the outcome on a lot of those things I just mentioned.
Right. Well, I think the single biggest thing that could help the spring season is something that I think a lot of people, a lot of administrators in college athletics thought would be already in place, and that's a reliable rapid test. Because, again, some of these issues I'm talking about, the long-term heart effects and everything else that's going on for those who have recovered, I mean, that's just the reality, unfortunately, of where we're at right now with the pandemic. But I think if school presidents could be assured that the guys that we're sending on the field on Saturday or whatever day you play in the spring are not positive, everybody is negative for COVID-19, that may create a greater comfort level. Right now, from what I've learned about the testing and just, you know, the unreliability of the rapid testing at this point and the saliva test not being available like many thought it would be, nobody can do that. Nobody can say for sure that this team we're sending on the field, everybody is negative for COVID-19. If you can do that in the spring, or really for all sports, I do think the comfort level may change a bit. Now you're also dealing with another optic issue, which is having, you know, these right now amateur athletes playing two seasons in one calendar year. So you do wonder if it gets to that, especially where these player movements are, if the players push back against that idea, saying, you know, we don't feel comfortable playing two seasons in one calendar year. But if most of the players are on board with that and the testing has improved, I think it's unrealistic to think everybody's going to be vaccinated, especially a group of people that isn't seen as high risk for COVID-19 by February or March or whenever you'd have to start this thing. But if the treatments are better and there's less concern about the optics of playing two seasons in one year, I think that you could try to pull it off.
Excellent points, Adam. We do appreciate, as Joe said, especially grinding out through everything. So we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and appreciate your insights.
All right, guys. Enjoy the day. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you. Adam Rittenberg, senior writer for college football, ESPN. Lots of great information coming from him as we continue on this developing story about college football, wanting to cover all points of view, whether it's from the medical side, from the player point of view as well, trying to just get everything in there so we can provide you as much information as possible with what's coming out. So up next, we're going to continue the discussion on college football here on Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, and taking care of us behind the glass, Marquise Munson. So much breaking news with college football happening, and as we just spoke with Adam Rittenberg, getting the feel for what's going on and talking about what Dan Patrick's show broke, about getting the feel of the Big Ten and pretty much seeing that coming. And the Big Ten being the leaders in this, as Rittenberg even mentioned, and I wanted to look up to make sure, because we talked about it way earlier in the show about some of the leaders of the presidents of the universities in the Big Ten, Joe, and I want to pat myself in the back for kind of looking at that.
Well deserved.
Thank you. So, for instance, the president of the University of Michigan, I'll start there, who is Dr. Mark S. Schlissel. Boy, that's a lot of S's in there. It's hard. He's a physician scientist leading the institution with a graduate of Princeton University and MD and PhD degrees from Johns Hopkins University, yeah, Michigan State, whose president is Samuel L. Stanley. And he's been the president of multiple institutions before. He has a Bachelor of Arts in Biological Sciences from the University of Chicago and also a medical degree from Harvard. So you're having guys leading universities that have medical backgrounds, which plays a big role. And then obviously the medical schools with Michigan and Northwestern, for instance, to throw it out there too. So I'm sure those are all playing roles in terms of where they're getting their information from and what they're doing to make decisions as well. And granted, there's great medical schools in all the conferences, but like Rittenberg even said, one of the reasons why they're probably leading the way is just given the information the Big Ten has as well.
Right, and listen, on this virus, as many people have pointed out, there has been conflicting information, conflicting science, different opinions, and there have been people that I still listen to who have changed their mind on things, and that's the thing about a virus that is this young. It will continue to happen. I mean, it's this worldwide race to understand it, to study it, to try to treat it, to try to vaccinate against it, all these things. And it's just everything's accelerated, but this is very, very early in the life of a virus that I would presume, we're going to be living with moving forward long term. At some point, we'll be able to deal with it, and I think we'll move on, and life will return to normal. Obviously, we aren't there yet. And Rittenberg, I think, brought up a thing that can't be brought up enough because, and not that even the arguing about this at this point really matters that much. It's these decision makers are making the decisions. Like, they've got the information. There isn't a lot you can throw at them right now. But one thing that is coming to them are these concerns about long-term, damage to hearts. There's some studies about lung damage as well, lung capacity. And
which is an athlete's livelihood.
Yeah, like if you're right, if you're a pro athlete and that gets affected, especially depending on what sport you play, like baseball, you can probably tolerate some sort of thing like that and still be an effective baseball player, but in a lot of sports that would not be the case. So it's just there's just so much to it, and yeah, however you want to frame it, we've said liability a lot on this show today. I mean, I do think that's really the bottom line is that you don't know if things like this turn out to be true, and if people are affected long term down the road, what that could mean. And obviously, as Adam also pointed out, if the testing right now is not where it needs to be, and maybe it can be better in a few months, that's one, because a lot of people are going to say, well, what's going to change? And we don't know, but that's one possibility. It's probably more realistic than everybody's ready for the vaccine now in January.
Right. And what we're seeing too is, and I've seen this posted on multiple social media sites, is we're seeing the live reaction to the scientific method. I mean, most of the time when something's coming out, it's because scientists have already discovered something. They've tested it multiple times. They have an actual hypothesis that's been tested through and through to become something that's more of a rule, something that has been confirmed multiple times, that is 99.9% true based on different testing. But with it being so novel and just hearing about this in the winter, we're going through this of, oh, we made an observation, and then midwinter we're asking the question, then we form a hypothesis on this, and then we're starting to make predictions. Some predictions are right, some predictions are wrong. That's why we're seeing different things with symptoms, all the different things on mask wearing, all the different things on asymptomatic carriers and the spread of it as well. Things are completely changing all the time because, well, the virus mutates. The virus is doing all these things that are brand new that we just don't know about. And so we're discovering this on the fly. And most of the time, we're not hearing about science on the fly. And so we're having to do this and live our lives with science changing on the fly, because that's what happens. The science is always truth, what we see, but that truth changes. It's always changing because you discover different truths within it. And you can disprove things and prove things, but it's always changing because we're discovering new things about it. And that's, I think, been a difficult concept for some folks, because change and not getting things right all the time means that person can't be meteorologists get the flack all the time. Weather is a lot of times unpredictable, but you know the basic science around it and can make predictions, but it's not always going to be 100% right because things change. That's what science does.
Yeah, no, that's well explained on the scientific method. We are all watching it. We're all in the virtual laboratory right now,
right,
for these things that, like you said, normally it's not light of day until way later in the process. So, yeah, there's been a lot of changes of minds and a lot of different information. Also, I'd still rather listen to any of those people than the amateur epidemiologists who have said stuff from the start that's absolutely, utterly ridiculous. And we can get into the whole what's going to happen this week, Justin, is that if this carries on, as it looks like it will, then we will see an expanded version of what we saw last night, which was, let's play the blame game. There will be people who blame sports media people for reporting, hey, this could happen. Look at the liability. Look at the issues. Look at the health and safety. Look at the testing. Don't be so sure you're getting college football. Look at the society. Look at how the virus is growing. And somehow those people turned into rooting against football, which makes no sense. But there will be a lot of that. There will be people who blame the people who downplayed it and who perhaps influence people to not take it seriously, to not wear masks, to not care, to say, hey, you worry about it, then that's fine with you. I'm living my life. The problem is it's an infectious disease and you can spread it without symptoms and make it worse for everyone and kill other people. Honestly, I'm going to try to stay away from that, Justin. It's the virus, okay? It's the virus's fault. And we can go back and talk about how it was handled from the top, how different states handled it, whatever you want to do. All we can do at this point, to me, is try to move forward and get better and hope that things get better and work out. Like the blame game, which is just going to get absolutely unbearable this week, really does nothing productive.
It's going to get.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, look, it's bad. It will get worse.
Well, for me, my thing is that why would sports media be cheering against sports happening, actually cheering instead of providing information, but cheering when cheering for it would mean loss of job? That'd be saying
it has meant loss of job.
You know what? I want to lose my job. I hope sports don't happen. That's asinine to think about.
It is.
Because it's just reporting information. You want to know the information, people are going to provide it to you. You may not like that information, but it's still going to get provided to you, so you stay up to date with what's going on. I don't know many people that would be actively cheering against it, especially if sports is their job, because that's their money. That's how they have a livelihood. People don't want to have to go on unemployment, especially we don't know with what securities are going to get and benefits and everything like that. As someone currently on from his day job on furlough, I don't cheer for this to not happen. I want things to happen safely, happen in the right manner, happen the right way that we can do it safely and go on and live. But I don't think people are actively cheering against it, which is what's ridiculous to me, because it's like cheering to lose your job. Do you cheer to lose your job like that? No.
No.
People don't. And we're going to have so much more information coming out in the next 2 days, which is just crazy to think about how much more is going to break.
And what bothers me more, obviously, honestly, than the cheering for thing is like seeing someone like Danny Cannell tweet that, but also basically say, like, this is why we're where we are, like media reporting on this, but I guess being too negative, which, again, to me, like, if you're pointing out that these decision makers are skeptical and they have this A, B, C, D concern, that, so if they tell you something, are you supposed to not report it?
Right.
I've heard the, oh, you didn't talk to all the decision makers who were positive and optimistic. I don't think anyone's being silenced here in this process. I think even though the conferences are on different pages, there's sort of an overwhelming feeling because of all the challenges and all that can't be done that this was going to be tough once the virus started going the wrong way in June. So again, like, hey, I'd love to think that we in this industry have that kind of power. I think if we did have that kind of power, and I think all the screaming from a couple months back, especially about, please, if you want this sport, you've got to do these things. Just do these simple things.
Hunker down.
Then I think that it would have worked. It didn't work. We don't have that kind of power, and no one is rooting against sports. That's just insane. And as you said, people are going to lose jobs. People have lost jobs. And we talk about college towns. We talk about the college sports industry. We talk about people losing their lives, which has happened a lot. It's all terrible. Unfortunately, we have not been able to be on the same page in this, and that's just frankly really depressing.
And we look at this too, and it's not just college football. We're seeing how this virus affects it to where if you can't have sports happening, that means you have lots of students losing scholarships, sports programs getting canceled, just completely swiped from universities. You had one successful instance of it being saved with Alabama Huntsville, which
right.
You honestly use the virus as an opportunity to cancel the program, even though it was going that way anyway.
And there were other sports cut in the same manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Taking advantage of that as well to say, oh, well, we're blaming the virus, and that's the reason why we have to get rid of it. But you're going to see more and more programs and scholarships cut because of this. Nobody wants that. You want people to be successful, to have an opportunity to succeed in life, to play the sport they love, be able to earn a scholarship, and to make a living on this as well. If that's the skill that they have, to be able to make a living on the sport that they love and to make a living on it, we want that. We all want that. Everybody, the fans want it. Everybody wants it, but done in a safe manner. And just like Rittenberg said, if we get better testing as well, do we have better information coming to us to have better decisions to be made? And that's what's so difficult with this, because we're learning so many new things all the time. Yeah. Okay.
Well said.
Thank you. Up next, back to some Predators talk. Rehash what we've been discussing here. Predators out of the qualifiers. NHL draft lottery coming up later today. And we'll discuss more of that here on Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson, and Nashville Predators. Potential to have some major change happen today, this afternoon, the NHL Draft Lottery, 5 p.m. Central Time, happening, and it'll be broadcast on NBC Sports. Potential 12.5% opportunity to get the number one draft pick in the draft that's coming up in October.
12.5%. It's not terrible.
It's not terrible. I mean, it's better
than
something. 11%.
That's right. It's better than 9%.
Is that a better percentage than their power play last year? is that too much of a burn?
That's very nice.
But 12.5% to get Alexi Lafreniere. You know I do this just to
oh, I know, because I could never even do it. I was like, Alexis Lafreniere.
Peter Laviolette. So the Nashville Predators obviously getting kicked out, and wanted to rehash this because it's still a topic of conversation here in the city. Obviously the first opportunity to talk about it today after what happened Friday afternoon. But the Predators overall outplaying the Arizona Coyotes, almost said Phoenix, because it's still just muscle memory.
It's fine.
It's fine, even though, you know, they're way out and near the desert. But get ousted, even though Darcy Kuemper basically stole the series from them. And the way that the Predators outplayed them in times obviously is frustrating to people watching, because they were doing so many of the right things, actually getting high-danger opportunities on net. Still, Kuemper was making saves. They were out-shooting their opponent in many ways, high-danger opportunities as well, yet still would leave a period being down. Extremely frustrating, but still a change is needed.
Yeah, I think in the first period of the last two games was almost just identical.
Yeah.
I do think that certainly they outplayed them, and they played very well, I think, for most of those games, which, again, is sort of like, okay, so if you played well, you like how you played, you just lost in four to Arizona in
no
a five-game series.
No
finish, and also, does that not tell you that you need something different here? Like, and again, if you are happy with having this improved effort, and look, it's better than Dallas last year, it's better than during the season, everybody knows you're not going to have the exact same everything from postseason to the 82-game regular season slog, but it shouldn't be that different. So that's another thing, too. And, I think I start with Ryan Johansson on that. We saw he can be great. Now, can you sustain that over a long period of time? Probably not at that level. But I think you can be closer to that level more often. And what does that mean to your bottom line? What does that mean to how you enter the postseason?
I mean, you throw that out there, too. Earlier, I think in the 6 o'clock hour, you said if he just played 75% of that effort.
75% of the time.
75% of the
time. Not good at math, but I think that's still – better.
I'm reminded of Anchorman right now. Of a certain cologne. But if Ryan Johansson can play like that more often than not in the regular season, the difference it could make to this team in terms of just standing. And it's not that often that an 8 seed will make a run like they did before. You still want to put yourself in a better position to succeed overall, because more often than not, the higher seed is making that run because you just have better matchups in place. So the things they do in the regular season obviously can greatly affect the future because of the seeding that you're getting. And we saw that just with the power play. Now, granted, the power play improved, because in the playoffs, their power play looked pretty darn good, and they were fourth overall in the league, 28.6%, way higher than average. There's one thing you can say, hey, they improved upon that, and they did look better. And we saw that during training camp as well, that they focused a lot on special teams, and the power play was a big thing of just getting more creative, and we saw that.
And more human and less robotic, right?
Yeah. Just move it around.
Move it around, but also, hey, you got an opportunity. Go! Shoot the puck right now.
Cross-ice
passes. You don't need to set it up every time. No, I thought they got a lot better
there. Yeah, they got a lot better there, but there's still some changes that absolutely need to be made. And we look at this, and it's frustrating to see some of the things, too, based on contracts, based on what changes you could make, what would be tradable contracts, all these different things that we see. But there are certain players that stepped up, like Ryan Johansson. I thought that Ryan Ellis overall offensively was producing much better. Philip Forsberg did what he needed to do. I mean, 5 points in 4 games, 3 goals, 2 assists there. Victor Arvidsson being healthy. I mean, he had 3 goals in 4 games. Granted, he did leave game 4 after getting that puck to the ribs. So hopefully he's okay as well. Nick Bonino, overall, he had a timely goal as well, and some great defensive plays from Nick Bonino, which is what you want from your third-line center as well.
Yep.
But overall, more depth scoring. And we say this, how many times do we say that about a hockey team, about we want depth scoring, we need depth scoring, all these different types of things. The Predators did not have that in this series, the depth scoring that puts you over the edge. And so often, I say, is that the third line is what will make the difference oftentimes because of matchups and who that third line is matching up against.
Which we saw in the Colorado series.
Exactly. The America line for this Predators team could have made a huge difference if Craig Smith got hot or Rocco Grimaldi put another one in. But that third line, because you don't know, especially as the home team with the matchup getting that last change, that, hey, if you can send the third line out and they can produce, that means your other two lines, your top six, are going to get matched up even better against a third-pairing defense as well. The thing is, the second line didn't produce. Therein lies the rub. That they didn't have that produce like it needed to produce. And even if it was just a goal or two here or there, it was a tightly contested series overall. That would have made a tremendous difference, having the second line produce just a little bit.
And so that's where I think the changes have to come. I think you and I would agree that if you can make some kind of a deal to move Kyle Turris, that would be great. I have taken the next step of, if you can't buy him out, open it up, you're not so sure about that.
I just don't like buyouts overall.
Yeah.
But if that's the only thing you can do, then you have to do it. That's the only thing, because the flat cap coming in, which makes it very, very difficult. And if you want to still be near a cap team, makes it very difficult. But again, I will agree, if that's the only option you have, if no one else is going to take it, then you just have to buy it out and then move on from there and hope some youth comes in. Last year's draft was a really good draft for the Predators. I believe this year has potential because they have that, they'll have their first pick, which could be number one overall or 11, 12, which still is pretty good in a deep draft. And then you have 2 seconds and 2/3. You're replenishing the cupboard, which got so dry overall that what all the prospect experts were saying, the Predators were near the bottom quarter or worse in terms of prospects. And now you try to replenish that cupboard, which would lead to in the next 3 to 5 years, those guys appearing potentially in the lineup. We see that, but now we have people asking, well, what's going to happen now? What's the future of Pecorino? 1 year left on his contract. Is he going to even play at all next year just to be the backup to use of Saros? Is Saros the starter of the future with the average performance that he had during playoffs? And we say average because you look at the numbers, it was average at most.
I mean, he was the worst in the playoffs in
right.
goals against expectation.
Yeah. So you have those numbers to look at. He made some quality saves, but he didn't steal any games. And that was another issue, too. Darcy Kuemper stole games. Other goaltenders, Pecorino in the past would steal games. There are many times you see him make an outlandish save where you say, how did he get that? That's stealing a game. Kuemper, we said that multiple times about Kuemper, right? How did he even stop that? Stealing games. Having that ability in the playoffs, a goaltender has to be hot and steal a game.
Right, and that is that's a really significant question moving forward for this team. I think I disagree with what Darren McFarland said earlier, that, you know, I asked him, does he think that UC Saros can have that kind of impact in the future? And I can't sit here and say zero chance of that happening, but I don't think we've seen indications that he can be what Rene was at his best.
Right.
Some of that may just be body length. I mean, I don't, you know, I heard that from a lot of people. Like when, you know, of course, as you lose a series, people are going to say, how did you not have Pecorino
right.
in there? It's like, I mean, his head would have been tall enough to stop the one that flipped over, you know.
That's
probably true.
Ball, yeah.
But it's more than that. And look, I think it was the right decision to go with him in this series. And I think he's a good goaltender. But do you need something more than that to really have a chance to do what you want to do in the postseason? I think that's possible. Connor Ingram is a promising prospect. I think it won't be long before it's Saros Ingram.
I agree.
And then what's his ceiling? I mean, I don't know. Yeah, but it may be that at some point you have to look outside the organization, which hasn't happened since. Fill in the blank for me. I mean, it's all been homegrown goaltenders.
But Dan Ellis.
Dan Ellis.
Yeah. Dan Ellis.
I mean, that's a big thing. It's not, I mean, everybody's going to talk about the forwards because I do, like they, as you said earlier in the segment, the second line, you got to figure it out. You know Matt Duchene is going to be there. You know he's there. So what can you do to maximize Matt Duchene to help him? He's got to help himself. He's got to play like he did for stretches of game four more often.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has to have better compliments than I think what Turris and Granlund were for him. And I know I'm saying Granlund in my clunky way and not your
fancy
way.
Well, no, you're saying it in the Americanized way, and that's totally fine and acceptable.
Well, I appreciate that. So let me ask you this. Alexis Lafreniere.
Alexis Lafreniere.
Dang it. Alexis Lafreniere. Okay.
There, yeah, see?
Alexis Lafreniere. Okay.
Yeah, Vigneault.
Let's say they get him. Say they get him at 5 o'clock. Preds win. Preds win the lottery. They're going to get him. Right away, instantly, what's realistic? Because, of course, they will immediately be like, oh, starring right away for the Preds. And that's...
Yep. He's a generational talent.
I think he's that good.
I put him in terms of... Let's say you look at the last 10 drafts of who went first overall. I put him in the bottom half of that, but that's still generational of number one overall. I mean, the potential to be like a Nathan MacKinnon. That's a face of the franchise type of player, right? Explosive talent. Put him right there is where I put Alexis Lafreniere. So you put him right off the bat on the second line with Matt Duchene. Options right off the bat. And if, say, for instance, a Filip Tomasino or Eli Tolvanen, potentially, I mean, depending on what camp goes, things like that, surrounding him with youth, but also guys that can shoot, I think that puts Duchene in an area that can make him successful as well, because he has guys that can hopefully get open and everything. But yeah, Alexis Lafreniere is a generational type of talent that would be the first superstar-esque type player for this team. Philip Forsberg hasn't risen to that occasion yet. He has shown elements of being elite and being a star, but hasn't been doing that consistently enough for us to say that he is an elite forward in this league and deserves to be recognized for it. He has flashes of it, absolutely. But the rankings, whenever they come out of, like, who are the top forwards in the NHL, he's not there for a reason, because the consistency is not there yet.
As I've read about Lafreniere, if I said that okay.
Yeah, baby.
Good skater, not elite. Elite playmaker, pretty close to elite shot.
Yeah.
That's sort of the book on him.
Yeah, and skating can come. I mean, that's one of the things that you can continue to work on. But if that's the kind of thing that if he's open – or he's finding somebody that's open, that instantly makes people around him better. And that's what you want.
We've built a Stanley Cup champion for next year. There you go.
Oh, God, the pressure. The pressure. Okay, up next, we're going to talk more about the changes we'd like to see made, what contracts you'd like to see expire, maybe potentially guys have moved around a little bit, the third pairing as well for the Predators. That's how we're going to finish up Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson. Discussing the Nashville Predators here and just some changes we'd like to see made. I want to revisit something because, for those of you that don't know, I wrote the book on Nashville, on the Nashville Predators. And I asked General Manager David Poile about the 1998 draft, because it's something that gets discussed and brought up, because this franchise has not been able to draft an elite forward high in the draft ever in franchise history. The one time the potential opportunity was there, Barkov didn't fall to them. And they took Seth Jones, which ended up being an asset to trade for Ryan Johansson. There's that.
Good player, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of great defensemen drafted.
Yeah, but they've never been awful enough to get the first or second overall. They've always been just good enough and make the playoffs, which is good for the franchise to make the playoffs. Obviously, brings in money, which means you can spend more money, things like that. But they've never been awful enough to do that, because when they've missed the playoffs, they've just been out of the playoffs aside from the Seth Jones year. So we go all the way back to 1998, when it's their first draft, and they have to trade up in the draft from 3 to 2, and they take David Legwand, which was a solid player for the franchise, but not a superstar forward, right? Vinny LeCavalier goes to Tampa Bay. The difference in point production, LeCavalier in his career, just over 1,200 games, 949 points. Legwand, just over 1,100 games, 618 points. So a difference of 300 points.
That's significant.
That's very significant. And so the significance of having an elite forward can make a difference for this franchise, because LeCavalier wanted to win a Stanley Cup with Tampa Bay. And then they somehow landed Martin St. Louis in free agency. How about luck for that, because he just didn't work out in Calgary. But just, I'm saying all this because that's the importance of being able to get forwards, and the Predators, unfortunately, have been able to develop star forwards. All of them come from really outside, unless you look at Victor Arvidsson right now, who was skipped over in a draft
right.
twice.
Yeah.
And comes in and has been able to be a proven performer when he's healthy, too. So Filip Tomasino has a potential. Maybe Eli Tolvanen, we look at this. So that's why, for me, to get it back to the scope of this segment, is the change needed is I want to see more youth come into this lineup, whether it's in forwards or defense. I want to see more, given an opportunity that had been in the organization, especially in the third pairing on defense, more young guys like an Alex Carrier, like a Frederick Allard. Bring in some of these guys and maybe be mentored by a veteran, but I want them to get a lot of playing time coming next season.
So you're more youth getting opportunity than take an asset people might consider close to untouchable and look to make a significant deal to bring someone in.
The reason why I say yes to that is because most players don't have the trade value that's going to bring in something that will make that difference immediately. Maybe you get a draft pick, but I don't think you're going – unless you're trading Roman Josi, I don't see the return.
He's on the untouchable list, right?
Right.
We've already said Duchesne. I mean, there's just no way.
For reasons.
Forsberg has – I mean, obviously, you're going to have to redo Forsberg soon here, but Forsberg right. on that list for me. I will say that I thought some about Johansson – going to the playoffs, not that it's easy to trade that contract.
Right, that's another reason.
But maybe, and then you watch him play in this postseason, and you're like, that's what he is. That's the guy. That's what you want.
Right.
You don't want to get rid of that. You don't want to lose that. The problem is, how do you feel about that being more the norm?
So with Johansson, I wouldn't say untouchable 100%. It'd be the right – and the thing is, every player for the right offer, right? I mean – what does it take for any player to be traded? What do the Islanders the 1 year try to throw out? What, 12 draft picks or something for at the draft? So every player could be traded potentially for the right price. I just don't see many players bringing the right price. So that's why we talked about the Turris, potential buyout. Bonino actually has trade value.
Yeah.
One year left as well, which makes it more appreciative to teams is that 1 year left, he's proven himself. Not saying I'm not calling for him to get traded. I'm saying there's actual value for Nick Bonino right now, which when you're going to trade, you trade him when he has value. Those are some of the things. The top line probably is not going to change. I don't see David Poile doing a fire sale unless something changes at the top as well. And I know people are calling for fire Poile. There have been people saying that. I just don't see it happening. Joe, do you see this happening just based on what you know, too, about the org?
Poile fired? No, I don't
see it. I just don't see it happening. We can't discuss that much because I don't see it being an actual solution right now from ownership.
Yeah, and I think it's, to me, just in general, ownership groups make that less likely than maybe one owner who is fed up or whatever. I mean, like I think that's far-fetched. I understand people being upset. I mean, David Poile has been on a cold streak here, and not a lot of what he's done has worked out in the last few years. And I think David Poile retiring at some point in the near future certainly seems plausible. But, no, I think David Poile is going to be the guy who tries to fix this, tries to really get out of this and change the trajectory. It's not going in the right direction. A guy like Ellis – also a hard deal to trade. A lot of years left, but you know, if a guy like Ellis had big return, you know, could he be looked at? The problem is, you look at the, you know, the defensive top four, Dante Fabbro has had some growing pains. You're worried about your third pairing, you need to do something there. If you were to move an Ellis, then you're even in a tougher spot there. But again, we don't know what the return is. I'm just saying there could be a name other than, I think, those four names especially, top line and Josi.
Yeah.
Could be a name somewhere in there that you wouldn't automatically think of that actually gets actively discussed at some point here.
I mean, and we've seen in the past, Patrick Hornquist was traded for James Neal, which overall that worked out given the success the team had. We saw the Weber-Subban trade happen, which the only banners to be raised, really, is with PK Subban on this team.
And that's not coincidental.
No, it's not coincidental. That was changing. It was changing the trajectory of the team, like you just said. That's what PK Subban did. But then it was time, because given his contract, to move on from that. It was a risk move, and the reward was getting this close to the Stanley Cup. Really, really close. Then you have to move on. Now move on and try some youth. It's not a full rebuild. It's not a fire sale. It's giving opportunity and respect and confidence in what you've been trying to build on now to say, go prove yourself. And then if it's not working, you have a trade deadline, you have other opportunities during a season, and if it really doesn't work, then that's where you can look to move something else. I'm not saying give it a year to make a decision. I'm saying give it a year to try something else.
That makes sense. You should run this team.
No, no, no. I'm not qualified for that. I'm not. I'm saying this as a sports journalist opinion.
A lot of people not qualified for things that are saying a lot of stuff right now in the world. So, join the club.
Yeah, I will. I will. Maybe one day. One day, I'll get my start in junior hockey first.
There you go.
And move on from there and build up. I'm not going straight to the top first.
The Nashville Mighty Drunks. Are you the GM too?
No, I'm not the GM. I'm just the captain.
You got the C though.
Got the C. Well, Joe, thank you. Thank you for today.
Appreciate you bet.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Did an awesome job. Well, I thought we had a heck of a fast-moving show and a lot of stuff going on. This is not your typical August.
No, lots of breaking news continuing to happen. Make sure you're tuning in this afternoon and this morning and this afternoon. Darren Donick and Chase, Jared and the GM, they have you covered with all the breaking news, especially in college football. So for Marquise Munson behind the glass, Joe Rexo, this has been Justin Bradford. Thanks for listening to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No